A little air guitar. Mm-hmm. I thought you were doing some air guitar on that. Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite hangout as we do our favorite thing, talk a little politics. There is absolutely nothing to talk about, Brandon. I don't know what we're going to do for the next 30 minutes. No, just kidding, of course.
I think my head's going to explode.
Yeah, there's so much going on, as always, every week. The times we live in, there are a lot. We've got, of course, the big announcement. Papa Joe is in the race,
wow.
Brandon. I don't know what we're going to do. Lots of conversation around the viability of the quote-unquote front runner of the Democratic primary, Joe Biden, former vice president. But before we get to that, let's just leap right on in with some more 2020 news, Brandon.
You know what? He was not the only person to announce for president this week, Jay.
That's right. So let's start off with that. We have a Congressman Seth Moulton from Massachusetts is in the race. Brandon, tell us a little bit about Congressman Moulton.
Well, Congressman Moulton is an Iraq War veteran. He's a Massachusetts lawmaker. He actually made some waves in 2014 when he upset a long-term member in the Democratic primary. So he's got a little bit of experience running against Democrats. The message is pretty bland, I guess I'd say. Pretty straight up the middle, healthcare for all. He champions what he calls a Green Corps, which is basically the Civilian Conservation Corps from the 30s, with respect to how to sort of advance environmental issues, toughen gun laws. I responded with an okay and a period, not an okay and a slammer, right? Like just okay, you know?
I call this the Mayor Pete Buttigieg effect, because if a 37-year-old mayor from South Bend, Indiana, can suddenly find himself almost leading or in a strong third place, then pretty much anything is possible, and that's probably what Seth Moulton is thinking. But I will say this. He is an interesting guy. He is a millennial like Mayor Pete. Incredibly decorated war veteran, as you said, Ivy League educated, Harvard. Really
too much Harvard.
Harvard squared. Let's just leave it at that. But he's got some interesting ideas. Interesting in the sense that he positions himself, or at least likes to say that he's sort of this moderate or sort of new generation candidate. I'm not sure what really matters with any of this when you consider some of the other candidates in there. When you've got 20, you got to find your lane, and you got to widen it as much as possible. I don't know if there's any room for any of these guys now, especially when you have so much oxygen taken up by two or three candidates.
I think that's a great point. I actually thought about this a little bit. Like, what's the advantage of jumping in like right before Joe Biden jumps in and after, 18 other people jumped in? I think one advantage is to kind of lay down a marker for a future cabinet position. Like you say, he's a smart person. He's got some good experience. That's an opportunity for him later. Maybe a VP spot if things work out. I mean, we've seen some VPs pick sort of out of nowhere, so it's not unlikely that you could pick somebody who is in the arena but not necessarily with a lot of experience. And maybe to expand a national fundraising base, right? This is going to give him some exposure, which otherwise he might not get, but very little exposure, right? But actually, overexposure could be a problem. Beto O'Rourke is facing some issues in terms of staffing. Jay, what's going on there?
Yeah, on there. So two of his initial staffers from his Texas Senate run, who had carried on and were sort of acting in a voluntary capacity, they were former Sanders people. In a bid, as they say, to try to professionalize the O'Rourke campaign, they've moved on. They were never actually formal staffers, but they've moved on. And this sort of, I think, is part of the fallout with Jennifer Donnelly, who's now the campaign manager, who came over from the Obama campaign, is running. And so you've got a kind of a different flavor, a shift to a more Obama-centric universe when you consider some of the staffers. I don't think it's a big deal in sort of that he's losing staff. I think it definitely indicates kind of a pivot and a shift to a much more of the sort of the moderate, progressive O'Rourke that we think might have a little more of a lane here.
I think you're right. I don't think this is anything more than just growing pains. All organizations face this. You've got members who are running as, mayors. You've got members who are running as members from Congress. Like, they have different staff who've got different expertise. I think for O'Rourke, the real challenge is how do you capture that lightning again, right? And can the model that worked in Texas work nationally? The fear is that if you lose people who were good at that and could capture that enthusiasm, leave, can they do it? So we'll see. I think O'Rourke probably, given the last couple of days, has dropped a little bit. The polling seems to show this as well. So I think they're struggling a bit, but I don't think this indicates exactly why they're struggling.
Yeah, it sounds like to me what they're trying to do is marry sort of that grassroots effort that he had for the U.S. Senate race in Texas kind of going everywhere, you know, sort of the back of the truck kind of thing, with a more conventional campaign structure. And that's hard to do. My understanding is that they are working, you know, they've heavily invested in Iowa and New Hampshire. He's traveling a lot. We know he's a talented retail candidate. But again, when there's 20 people in a race, you've got to do something to set yourself apart. And I think the candidate that's probably making the biggest push to set herself apart, that's Elizabeth Warren. Almost daily, she puts out a new policy proposal. She finally got one that has, lack of a better word, gone viral.
Yeah.
And that is a pretty massive and large attempt to essentially rewrite the way we do student loans, both currently and in the future in the United States.
Yeah, so she's proposed about a $640 billion debt cancellation. The plan would eliminate debt for students with up to $50,000 in student loans and each person with less than $100,000 in household income. She has got more policy proposals than Bernie has got donors, Jay. She's got more policy proposals than Cory Booker has rushing yards. She has got more policy proposals than Joe Biden has wrinkles. We could do this all day.
Oh,
okay?
I know. I mean, we joke about it, but it's very rare to see a candidate put this much out this early and with this level of detail. It's an interesting proposal just on the substance of it. It certainly started that conversation. We've had candidates in the past sort of say, you know, free college for all, or we're going to deal with the student loan debt. We probably never had one that's been this specific, showing funding streams and looking at sort of rewriting the tax code. We know that she is arguably a national expert when it comes to sort of regulatory or financial service industries and tax and the tax code. No one knows it better than her in the U.S. Senate. She started a consumer protection agency for that very reason. So there's a lot going on there. I think this is potentially the opioid style issue of this cycle.
Yeah.
You know, the issue that rallies sort of young people, millennials up, because this is just a ticking time bomb. $1.5 trillion in debt that exists right now. It's a real problem.
Millennials can't buy houses, they can't invest, they can't save, and it's creating a real economic ripple effect. I think you're right that the politics of this are smart. In fact, one of the groups that you saw expanding exponentially in the last election was millennials. The biggest change in turnout from 14 to 18 occurred among urban, educated, and the young. That's a group that she can court with this kind of policy. It's still a big lift, I think, in terms of the funding, in terms of getting it through, but it's a big think idea, and I think that's something that would definitely appeal to a very core of the Democratic Party.
Well, shifting gears a little and talking about sort of current policy in the White House, President Trump has put out a new order essentially canceling any waivers issued to countries that are doing business with Iran, essentially trying to cut off all of their existing oil production and putting it on the market to really, I think, put the squeeze on them. This dramatically affects countries like China and India that get a large chunk of their oil from Iran. For, you know, selfishly here in Texas, it means the price of crude is probably going to go up and domestic shale production becomes that much more important. But this has big policy ramifications because the president continues to say we are going to lean heavily in the direction of sort of Saudi Arabia and heavily away from Iran. And it doesn't look like there's an end in sight.
Yeah. And there's kind of an ongoing chess match here where the president wants to use their economic leverage to try to get Iran to the negotiating table. The hardline stance here, though, is muscling out their ability to negotiate. Trying to pressure Iran in the form of these military threats or economic sanctions has not worked, right? We've seen this for 6 months. They've pushed back on Mike Pompeo and his desire for regime change. Iran is in no hurry to negotiate. And what they want to do is basically wait out the Trump administration, which may be politically smart. So this is a real dangerous territory here for Trump. And what they've done essentially is kind of escalate this and ratchet up the kind of heat in the room, and that can create some possible problems in negotiating down the road.
Well, continuing on, we had the big bombshell, Brandon, on the Mueller report that came out, or the redacted version, and that, frankly, that left us with more questions than answers.
Still,
and we thought it was going to be over, but well, we really didn't think it was going to be over.
It's never.
But it's
over.
Created sort of this domino effect, and we've got a lot of moving pieces now dealing with it. The president has sort of taken a position. The first sort of a series of deadlines have come and gone. Number one being there was a congressional committee that had asked to see the president's taxes. The chairman of the House Ways and Means, by statute, has the ability to get the tax returns of President Trump. He is refusing to comply. You've got an oversight committee versus the president on, as it relates to sort of his financial records in general, looking at it. We know that his sister essentially had to step off the bench as a result of this question. And then we've got renewed calls for potentially impeachment. We want to have Robert Mueller come testify. A lot going on. What is going on with the Mueller fallout?
Just a lot, right? It just like nuclear winter continues to rain down. I'd make a Game of Thrones reference here, but I don't know enough about it to make one. It seems like Game of Thrones, though, doesn't it? Everyone's got swords and there's battles and dragons. Like, it's just a kind of a big mess. But let me just wrap this up politically here in terms of how I see it. I think that the problem for the president is that they're trying to stiff arm Congress. That will only go for so long. I think the fight itself is hurting Trump. The stonewalling that they've engaged in is problematic and will ultimately, I think, be a political liability. The problem for Congress is that the threats to hold particular members in contempt doesn't work. We've seen it happen in the past, and they've gotten no extra information. It happened during the Obama years. It happened during the Bush years. Congress doesn't have the leverage it needs. So I think politically speaking, we're still kind of in a holding pattern. Ultimately, it's likely going to have to be the courts that fight this out. But of course, an election's coming, so it could to some degree be moot if the president doesn't win re-election.
Well, shifting gears, let's talk a little Texas. A lot going on here in the Lone Star State. We have been talking for months, speculating for months, whether John Cornyn would get kind of that top flight challenger. There was some talk about Joaquin Castro, the congressman from San Antonio. But MJ Hager has announced she is the she ran for Congress back in 2018 with this really interesting kind of viral video, the kind of opening doors that really do. Mm-hmm. She's a decorated combat veteran, really one of the first one of the people who pushed to have women in combat. Really interesting here. She's got a lot of support from national fundraising. She's running, and you already see John Cornyn pushing back hard. And inexplicably, in a Twitter beef with Patton Oswalt, the comedian who is supporting MJ Hager.
Right, and Patton, frankly, owned Cornyn on this, right? If you go back and look at the exchange, it's honestly pretty funny. And Cornyn is not in the same Twitter category. They cannot go toe-to-toe on this. So it was a mistake to get involved. The origin of it basically was that in the video, which is a pretty good video, it's a play on the Doors video you talk about, there's a kind of Twitter interaction between Patton Oswalt and MJ Hager where they kind of have a live version of Patton Oswalt talking to MJ Hager. And what the Cornyn campaign did was go back and look at all of the offensive tweets that Patton Oswalt had sent, mostly jokes, but obviously there's some stuff in there that's pretty raunchy. So this became this kind of ongoing Twitter beef. It is an unusual situation, but I think it's going to give you a flavor for kind of where this race will go. The Cornyn campaign basically is pushed back saying, you know, this is Hollywood Hager, right? She's going to get all her money from Hollywood. She's Chuck Schumer's hand-picked candidate. I don't think that'll resonate too well too far, but certainly for a kind of group of Republicans, it will. She is, frankly, an impressive person,
yes.
Right? I mean, she is a Purple Heart Award winner, like you say. The way she describes what happened in Afghanistan, her like hanging off of the helicopter, returning fire on the Taliban, like it is the stuff of a movie rather than running for Senate. Maybe that'll be part of it, but she is really impressive. What's not impressive, though, has been her fundraising to date. Her account is pretty low, so she hasn't been sort of keeping that up. But she did raise $5 million for her race against John Carter, so she is going to be a formidable candidate. But polling suggests that she's really not the top choice. Joaquin Castro, who's still kind of, you know, cooling his heels, is still the top choice.
So I'll say this about that. I think Joaquin Castro would certainly be a major and an interesting choice if he ran. The problem, I think, is he doesn't seem to really be running.
Yeah,
and
you
I
don't
say
think
that,
he will.
I really don't. And the reason I said this is when you look at the last round of fundraising report, he raised $23,000. That's not a guy that's looking to run for the U.S. Senate.
That's a great point. That's,
I mean, he has a very, very safe seat. I don't think there's any danger for him to do so, but that sense of urgency, that sort of desire. To give you some contrast, Lizzie Pannell Fletcher here in CD7, who knows she's going to have a tough race, raised almost $500,000.
Yeah. That's a great point. So you think that this is a race he doesn't see as winnable, or you think that this is a race he simply doesn't want?
Yeah, I really am not sure if he thinks he wants to be a member of the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's very likely, you know.
Boring over there.
Yeah, there's nothing. And I'll say this. I'll say this right now. If you've got a Department of Homeland Security office that's open, and Dan Patrick, the Lieutenant Governor of Texas, is tapped for that. The Lieutenant Governor's office is wide open.
Yeah.
Will be open in 2020. And Joaquin Castro would be almost the ideal candidate for that seat. Well, Brandon, before we get to 2020 races, we've got some 2019 races. And we're here in Houston, and we know we've got a big mayor's race in November. But we've got mayor's races, two really critical ones in San Antonio and in Dallas that are happening right now this week. Coming up, I think early votes already started. They're going to have they're going to be dealing with this in May, the first week of May. But let's talk about them because they're really, really interesting. Dallas has like 25 people running practically, almost like the Democratic 2020 primary. The Dallas Morning News took the unprecedented step of not endorsing a single candidate, but three candidates because they couldn't make up their mind.
Like a third of the full field being endorsed, right? How is that supposed to be helpful, right? Like they have to call this down. They couldn't make a choice. I think the fact is that there are lots of good candidates in the field, right? Miguel Solis, who is on the school board, Jason Villalba, who is a former member of the Texas House, Eric Johnson, who is a current member of the House. Like, these are all individuals who've got a good resume. They got a good record. They've been pretty proactive. So I think this is pretty interesting, and they've got lots of good choices. But Dallas doesn't seem to think so. Their turnout has been at about 2%. And the fact that this is a May election is awful, right? It never links up with the midterm, and people are simply not paying attention.
Right. When you've got 10 candidates and just dispersed throughout there, not huge names, but well-regarded names, you're not going to drive any kind of turnout. I agree with you. I think, to me, the two candidates to watch are Solis and Eric Johnson, mm-hmm. partially because of sort of money and resources and support base. In the case of Solis, he's the one that's sort of the grassroots campaigner, representing Dallas ISD, which has massive overlap with the city. And Eric Johnson is incredibly popular, particularly in the African-American community.
Yeah.
I think those are two big bases there. So setting yourself up. But you could get into a runoff with 10% of the vote.
Right. Your friends and family could put you into the runoff. I want to throw in a nod here to the fact that my hometown of Plano is also having elections, and they have had a serious interaction with the governor. The governor is embraced and endorsed a couple of candidates. There's been a lot of interaction and sort of back and forth about sort of high density building and whether or not Plano sort of the sleepy, you know, kind of suburb it used to be. So the governor's getting involved in that race. Not others, but just that one, which is really interesting.
That's right. The mayor of Texas, Greg Abbott.
He should be mayor of Plano.
We talk about this all the time. Well, in San Antonio, there's an interesting race going on. So the incumbent mayor, Ron Nirenberg, who himself was able to, he was a council member. He beat an incumbent in Ivy Taylor just 2 years ago, is facing a pretty strong challenger from a councilman, Greg Brockhaus. Now, what makes that race interesting is that Brockhaus is effectively running as the candidate, stop me if you've heard this before, of the firefighters union.
Seems familiar. Yeah.
It seems familiar here because you're seeing a similar pattern of what happened earlier in Dallas and now here in Houston as well. Houston in particular has got this ongoing dispute with the firefighters union, but Brockhaus is the candidate for the firefighters. They are in a long-running dispute, much like we've seen here in Houston. And so you've got this back and forth going mm-hmm. on.
They've solved their problem, though, right? Didn't they negotiate the raise for firefighters in the city? So that's all been fixed, but
well,
not
through the
Houston.
Same way, they went to the ballot box and got specific deals done through voter referendum, not unlike what you had here.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens there. I still think it's Nuremberg's race, but now the whole debate has been about the debates because Nuremberg refuses to sort of debate with Brockhaus. Brockhaus himself has got a lot of sort of, I think, some issues that he's dealing with. This should be an interesting race. There's other candidates in. We may or may not get a runoff, but we'll see.
We'll see. Well, speaking of debate, Jay, should we legalize hemp in Texas? One lawmaker thinks so, right? Tracy King from Batesville is a Democrat, has a bill that's advancing fairly quickly to legalize hemp and hemp-derived extracts like CBD oil, so long as they contain less than 0.3% THC. Hold off on your spliffs, though, Jay, because this is going to be a long fight. The governor and lieutenant governor have both said they don't want to expand medical marijuana. This is not medical marijuana exactly, but we're probably in the same category. The problem is that there's a kind of legal gray area, right? Where federally, for federal laws, it's legal to have a small amount of THC. But in Texas, it's still apparently illegal, even though it's being sold in some places. So there's still a lot of ambiguity about what to expect. Do you think this is going to pass? And what's the future for sort of legalizing hemp or marijuana, medical marijuana?
Well, I really think there's sort of two separate issues. We know that in the case of sort of industrialized hemp, the growing of it, there's a lot of commercial applicability and just a whole variety of things. We know it's an environmentally sustainable way to, for example, to make paper. CBD oil has become, I think, increasingly a something that's been used, particularly for children with autism.
Yeah.
It's been found to be very helpful. So there's a lot of, I think, legitimate uses for it. This is a non-interactive drug in the way that with very limited amount of THC in it. So I don't think this falls into the same category as the medical marijuana issue. That unfortunately looks like it's not going to go anywhere. Right. Although you never can quite tell. I think I'm a lot more optimistic about about hemp at least being able to be legalized this session.
It's gotten this far, so there's probably more bipartisan support than for marijuana, but I am not sure. The Republicans talk all the time about the slippery slope effect, and you've got law enforcement who's against it, so I just don't know how far it's going to get. Another question mark, big question mark, is about property tax reform and school finance reform, Jay. They're all merged together like one big cupcake. What's going to happen here? What's the kind of latest?
Well, I mean, they are merged together because as our good friends Paul Bettencourt often says, Senator Bettencourt, you cannot get school finance fixed without getting property taxes fixed. They're sort of inextricably linked together. The Senate came out finally with their omnibus reform bill for public education. It still includes the $5,000 raise for teachers, which the House's version did not.
It's a little smaller.
The number of amounts are about the same, but there's a whole slew of issues in there that the House had already rejected.
Yeah.
And so it sort of begs the question. We've got less than 30 days now to try to get all this done. It's in committee. It'll probably pass. It'll probably pass out of the Senate.
Yeah.
The question is, how quickly can they reconcile two bills that have appreciable differences between each other?
And Cal Seliger has opened up a new front because now he's asking for appraisals to be capped, not just like the tax rate to be capped. I think he could get some consensus on this.
Yes.
Look, he's the median voter here, right? He's going to get the attention. The Republic of Seliger essentially strikes again.
And he's absolutely right. We know for a fact the biggest issue driving property taxes is not the rate. The rates in most cases are actually gone down. It's property values themselves. So Seliger's proposal is allow residential property rates to essentially flatten while commercial rates go up. Now, that's something that you would imagine all the Democrats would be in favor, and probably not that many Republicans. Seliger is, obviously, but maybe not a few others.
Yeah, and I think that the concern is that, they're close, but they're not really that close. We've got T-minus 30 days. They've done a lot more with a lot less time. I still think things could get done. I mean, you've got property tax issues embroiled in this. The Senate wants bigger cuts, deeper cuts than the House wants. That's an easy fix, right? The Senate wants more teacher pay than the House, but they both want some teacher pay. That's an easy fix, right? So I actually think that they're close. I think 30 days is enough time, but it's going to be complicated because this is obviously the kind of central issue of the session. It was the big thing in the election. Everyone's got a sort of stake in the game, so they definitely want to move on this, but it is going to take all of the rest of the session to make this happen. The good news, though, Jay, is that they may have extra time in the form of daylight savings time.
That's right. You know, back to talking about ending two really dumb things, at least from my perspective. They want to end daylight savings time. Senator Bettencourt, we talked about before, is the Senate sponsor on this bill. Great idea. They also want to end Confederate Heroes Day, which is one of those sort of weirdly anachronistic things that is out there. Why are we doing this? Why are we honoring essentially folks that were in open rebellion against the United States?
Yeah.
In both cases, we'll see if it passes. I kind of think daylight savings time in particular will.
You think it will?
I hope so. I hope.
How did you celebrate Confederate Heroes Day, Jay?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Brandon. Probably the same way you did.
There's been a real push towards removing a lot of sort of the vestiges of the Confederacy. I'm not sure this is going to have the kind of legal or legislative bandwidth to pass. I don't think anyone really cares. Eventually, it'll probably get moved, but it probably won't be right now, considering how much else they have to deal with. But daylight savings time is really interesting, right? You've got a contingent who wants to get rid of this. Generally speaking, legislators are either indifferent or they really care. There's actually a pretty big fight between two Republican members about this issue. But what effectively this would do was to send this to voters, right? And so the actual text would say the following. Which of the following do you prefer? Observing standard time year-round or observing daylight savings time year-round? It's confusing as all of these constitutional amendments are, but it's got a contingent that wants to get rid of it. I think having more daylight probably just means that there's more time for legislators to bicker. I'm not sure that's a good thing.
Yeah, look, I think at the end of the day, as long as you're not having to switch your clock back and forth, no one's really going
to
care.
You just don't want to have to change your clock.
That's
right?
All okay. It is. That's okay. All it is. Well, Brandon, let's get to the big news of the day, and that is Joe Biden, the former vice president, is in the race.
Big effing deal, right?
It is a big effing deal, to quote our vice president. Yeah. So, Brandon, let's break it down. What do you think about him getting in the race?
Yeah.
How do you see his prospects? What do you expect his campaign to look like going forward?
Well, if it wasn't a race before, it certainly is now. To quote Lyndon Johnson, Joe Biden's going to prove you can steal first base. I mean, this essentially changes the narrative. He's the clear front runner. The polls show him at that point. We'll see some bloom off the rose at some point. But the fact is that he survived what a lot of people didn't, right? And that is a kind of his own Me Too scandal, right? It wasn't as bad. He didn't harass anyone in a sort of direct way. But he made people feel uncomfortable. And that, I think, creates a real potential problem. But he survived it. He is pivoting towards a kind of moderate stance. I want to get your take on this, but it's interesting that he's not shying away from that. I'm not sure that's going to be as attractive this time around as it was maybe in 2012 or 2008, but the party's moved. He hasn't. And the question is where their two will meet.
To me, I think the singular message that he is trying to put out there is that I'm Joe Biden and I'm the only one who can actually beat Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is an existential threat to the future of the United States. And you have to subvert all of your other issues and the bickering and all the questions about everything else, because we have a common goal, a singular goal, and that's to defeat Donald Trump. And objectively speaking, none of these other 19 candidates are capable of beating him the way I can beat him.
But there's so many, though. Like, not one of them?
apparently not, in his mind.
I think you're right. I think that the Obama connection helps him with Democrats, but not as much as he would like. But it hurts among Republicans who don't like Obama. The fundraising question for me is still big. He's going to get big dollar donors. He's going to get a super PAC that's going to be, you know, Papa Joe Biden's PAC. But he can't raise smaller dollars the way that Bernie can or the way that Warren can. How's he going to compete?
Yeah, look, that's a good question, because he's an old school fundraiser, right? He's not going to have that viral sort of moment, where he's getting just tons of $20 contributors like the way Bernie does or the way O'Rourke has in the past or some of these other candidates that have now built an infrastructure. He's a non-ideological candidate, there's not a singular issue that defines him. For years before he became vice president, he was all about criminal justice, but the wrong kind. He was putting people away left and right. He was known for that. He was known for, obviously, you know, the whole issues around Anita Hill. He's now sort of reinvented himself as 8 years as Robin to Barack Obama's Batman. Yeah. We'll see how that kind of plays itself out. Look, when he ran in 2008, it's not that he wasn't a great candidate. He was an awful candidate. He was essentially finishing last in everything. It was a shock to many people that Obama picked him, and it was entirely because he liked him. And that's the one thing about Joe Biden. I think he's going to double down on this message, which is, I'm a grown-up, and I can beat Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And we cannot risk unproven candidates who can't beat him, because I can reach out, bring those voters back. You can sort of see that argument. The question is, will Democratic primary voters feel confident enough or in many ways feel not confident enough that any of these other candidates can do that?
Any debate he's in, he's going to use that as leverage, right? He is polling above Donald Trump in almost every poll when a head-to-head matchup. Nobody else is that close. Of course, it's early, but he's in a position where he can flaunt that. And if that is something which Democrats want above everything else, which it seems like they do, he's going to, I think, get the nomination.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our producer, Sophie Mall. Special kudos to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, your next candidate for president, Holstlander.
I'm J.R.
And I'm Brandon Runninghouse. We'll see you next week.